A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 6, Side 2. First Reporter. What is your lordship's comment on Sir Risha Thon Berker's statement that the radiation count on the northwest coast is 10 times the normal level? Defense Minister. I have not read the statement. First Reporter. Assuming it to be true, what could be responsible for such an increase? Defense Minister. The question calls for conjecture. Perhaps Sir Risha discovered a rich uranium deposit. No, strike that out. I have no comment. Second Reporter. Does your lordship regard Sir Risha as a competent and responsible scientist? Defense Minister. He has never been employed by my department. Second Reporter. That is not a responsive answer. Defense Minister. It is quite responsive. Since he has never been employed by my department, I have no way of knowing his competence or responsibility. I am not a scientist. Lady Reporter. Is it true that a nuclear explosion occurred recently somewhere across the Pacific? Defense Minister. As Madam well knows, the testing of atomic weapons of any kind is a high crime and an act of war under present international law. We are not at war. Does that answer your question? Lady Reporter. No, Your Lordship, it does not. I did not ask if a test had occurred. I asked whether an explosion had occurred. Defense Minister. We set off no such explosion. If they set one off, does Madam suppose that this government would be informed of it by them? Polite laughter. Lady Reporter. That does not answer my... First Reporter. Your Lordship, Delegate Gerulian has charged the Asian Coalition with the assembly of hydrogen weapons in deep space, and he says our Executive Council knows it and does nothing about it. Is that true? Defense Minister. I believe it is true that the opposition's tribune made some such ridiculous charge, yes. First Reporter. Why is the charge ridiculous? Because they are not making space-to-earth missiles in space, or because we are doing something about it? Defense Minister. Ridiculous either way. I should like to point out, however, that the manufacture of nuclear weapons has been prohibited by treaty ever since they were redeveloped. Prohibited everywhere, in space or on Earth. Second Reporter. But there's no treaty to prescribe the orbiting of fissionable materials, is there? Defense Minister. Of course not. The space-to-space vehicles are all nuclear-powered. They have to be fueled. Second Reporter. And there's no treaty to prohibit orbiting of other materials from which nuclear weapons might be manufactured. Defense Minister. Irritably. To my knowledge, the existence of matter outside our atmosphere has not been outlawed by any treaty or act of parliament. It is my understanding that space is chock-full of things, like the moon and the asteroids, which are not made of green cheese. Lady Reporter. Is your lordship suggesting that nuclear weapons could be manufactured without raw materials from Earth? Defense Minister. I was not suggesting that, no. Of course, it's theoretically possible. I was saying that no treaty or law prohibits the orbiting of any special raw materials, only nuclear weapons. Lady Reporter. If there was a recent test shot in the Orient, which do you think more probable, a subterranean explosion that broke surface, or a space-to-Earth missile with a defective warhead? Defense Minister. Madam, your question is so conjectural that you force me to say, no comment. Lady Reporter. I was only echoing Sir Risha and Delegate Gerulian. Defense Minister. They are free to indulge in wild speculation. I am not. Second Reporter. At the risk of seeming wry, what is your lordship's opinion of the weather? Defense Minister. Rather warm in Texarkana, isn't it? I understand they're having some bad dust storms in the southwest. We may catch some of it hereabouts. Lady Reporter. Are you in favor of motherhood, Lord Ragel? Defense Minister. I am sternly opposed to it, madam. It exerts a malign influence on youth, particularly upon young recruits. The military services would have superior soldiers if our fighting men had not been corrupted by motherhood. Lady Reporter. May we quote you on that? Defense Minister. Certainly, madam, but only in my obituary, not sooner. Lady Reporter. Thank you. I'll prepare it in advance. Like other abbots before him, the Dom Jethro Zerke was by nature not an especially contemplative man. Although, as spiritual ruler of his community, he was vowed to foster the development of certain aspects of the contemplative life in this flock, and, as a monk, to attempt the cultivation of a contemplative disposition in himself. Dom Zerke was not very good at either of these. His nature impelled him toward action, even in thought. His mind refused to sit still and contemplate. There was a quality of restlessness about him which had driven him to the leadership of the flock. It made him a bolder ruler, occasionally even a more successful ruler, than some of his predecessors, but that same restlessness could easily become a liability, or even a vice. Zerke was vaguely aware, most of the time, of his own inclination toward hasty or impulsive action when confronted by unslayable dragons. Just now, however, the awareness was not vague, but acute. It operated in unfortunate retrospect. The dragon had already bitten St. George. The dragon was an abominable autoscribe, and its malignant enormity, electronic by disposition, filled several cubical units of hollow wall space and a third of the volume of the abbot's desk. As usual, the contraption was on the blink. It miscapitalized, mispunctuated, and interchanged various words. Only a moment ago, it had committed electrical lèse majesté on the person of the Sovereign Abbot, who, after calling a computer repairman and waiting 3 days for him to appear, had decided to repair the stenographic abomination himself. The floor of his study was littered with typed scraps of trial dictation. Typical among these was one which bore the information, "Testing, testing, 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 testing. Damnation, why the crazy capitals, number, now is the time for all good memorizers to gum to the ache of the bookleggers. Drat, can you do better in Latin, number, now translate, necesse est epistulam sacri collegio, mitendam esse statim dictem? What's wrong with the blasted thing, number?" Zerke sat on the floor in the midst of the litter and tried to massage the involuntary tremor out of his forearm, which had been recently electrified while exploring the autoscribe's intestinal regions. The muscular twitching reminded him of the galvanic response of a severed frog's leg. Since he had prudently remembered to disconnect the machine before tampering with it, he could only suppose that the fiend who invented the thing had provided it with facilities for electrocuting customers, even without power. While tweaking and tugging at connections in a search for loose wires, he had been assaulted by a high-voltage filter capacitor, which had taken advantage of an opportunity to discharge itself to ground through the person of the Reverend Father Abbot, when Reverend Father's elbow brushed against the chassis. But Zerke had no way of knowing whether he had fallen victim to a law of nature for filter capacitors, or to a cunningly devised booby trap aimed at discouraging customer tampering. Anyway, he had fallen. His posture on the floor had come about involuntarily. His only claim to competence at the repair of polylinguistic transcription devices lay in his proud record of once having extracted a dead mouse from the information storage circuitry, thereby correcting a mysterious tendency on the part of the machine to write double syllables. Dub-double-ol, sil-sil-ababalzals. Having discovered no dead mice this time, he could feel for loose wires and hope heaven had granted him charismata as an electronic healer. But it was apparently not so. "Brother Patrick," he called toward the outer office, and climbed wearily to his feet. "Hey, Brother Pat," he shouted again. Presently the door opened and his secretary waddled in, glanced at the open wall cabinets with their stupefying maze of computer circuitry, scanned the cluttered floor, then warily studied his spiritual ruler's expression. "Shall I call the repair service again, Father Abbot?"
"Why bother?" Zerke grunted. "You've called them 3 times. They've made 3 promises. We've waited 3 days. I need a stenographer, now, preferably a Christian. That thing," he waved irritably toward the abominable autoscribe, "is a damned infidel or worse. Get rid of it. I want it out of here."
"The Aplac?"
"The Aplac. Sell it to an atheist." "No, that wouldn't be kind. Sell it as junk. I'm through with it." "Why, for heaven's sake, did Abbot Bomas, may his soul be blessed, ever buy the silly contraption?
Well, Domine, they say your predecessor was fond of gadgets, and it is convenient to be able to write letters in languages you yourself can't speak.
It is? You mean it would be. That contraption... Listen, brother, they claim it thinks. I didn't believe it at first. Thought, implying rational principle, implying soul. Can the principle of a thinking machine, man-made, be a rational soul? Bah! It seemed a thoroughly pagan notion at first, but do you know what?
Father,
nothing could be that perverse without premeditation. It must think. It knows good and evil, I tell you, and it chose the latter. Stop that snickering, will you? It's not funny. The notion isn't even pagan. Man made the contraption, but he didn't make its principle. They speak of the vegetative principle as a soul, don't they? A vegetable soul? And the animal soul? Then the rational human soul. And that's all they list in the way of incarnate vivifying principles, angels being disembodied. But how do we know the list is comprehensive? Vegetative, animal, rational, and then what else? That's what else, right there, that thing. And it fell. Get it out of here. But first I've got to get a radiogram off to Rome.
Shall I get my pad, Reverend Father?
Do you speak Alleghanian?
No, I don't.
Neither do I. And Cardinal Hofstraff doesn't speak Southwest.
Why not Latin, then?
Which Latin, the Vulgate or modern? I don't trust my own Anglo-Latin, and if I did, he'd probably not trust his.
He frowned at the bulk of the robotic stenographer. Brother Patrick frowned with him, then stepped over to the cabinets and began peering into the maze of sub-miniature circuit components.
No mouse, the abbot assured him.
What are all these little knobs?
Don't touch, Abbot Zerke yelped as his secretary curiously fingered one of several dozen sub-chassis dial settings.
These sub-chassis controls were mounted in neat square array in a box, the cover of which the abbot had removed, bearing the irresistible warning, factory adjustments only.
You didn't move it, did you? He demanded, going to Patrick's side.
I might have wiggled it a little, but I think it's back where it was.
Zerke showed him the warning on the box's cover.
Oh, said Pat, and both of them stared. It's the punctuation, mostly, isn't it, Reverend Father?
That and stray capitals and a few confused words.
They contemplated the squiggles, quiggles, quids, thingamabobs, and doohickey in mystified silence.
Did you ever hear of the Venerable Francis of Utah? The abbot asked at last.
I don't recall the name, Domine. Why?
I was just hoping he's in a position to pray for us right now, although I don't believe he was ever canonized. Here, let's try turning this what's-this up a bit.
Brother Joshua used to be some kind of an engineer, I forget what, but he was in space. They have to know a lot about computers.
I've already called him. He's afraid to touch it. Here, maybe it needs...
Patrick edged away.
If you would excuse me, my lord, I...
Zerke glanced up at his wincing scribe.
Oh, ye of little faith, he said, correcting another factory adjustment.
I thought I heard someone outside.
Before the cock crows thrice. Besides, you touched the first knob, didn't you?
Patrick wilted.
But the cover was off, and...
Hinc igitur effuge. Out, out, before I decide it was your fault.
Alone again, Zerke inserted the wall plug, sat at his desk, and, after muttering a brief prayer to St. Leibowitz, who in recent centuries had come into wider popularity as the patron saint of electricians than he had ever won as the founder of the Albertian Order of St. Leibowitz, flipped the switch. He listened for spitting and hissing noises, but none came. He heard only the faint clicking of delay relays and the familiar purr of timing motors as they came up to full speed. He sniffed. No smoke or ozone to be detected. Finally, he opened his eyes. Even the indicator lights of the desktop control panel were burning as usual. Factory adjustments only, indeed. Somewhat reassured, he switched the format selector to radiogram, turned the process selector to dictate record, the translator unit to southwest in and Alleghanian out, made certain the transcription switch was on off, keyed his microphone button, and began dictating.
Priority urgent to His Most Reverend Eminence Sir Eric Cardinal Hofstraff, Vicar Apostolic Designate, Provisional Vicariate Extraterrestris, Sacred Congregation of Propaganda, Vatican, New Rome.
Most Eminent Lord, in view of the recent renewal of world tensions, hints of a new international crisis, and even reports of a clandestine nuclear armaments race, we should be greatly honored if Your Eminence deems it prudent to counsel us concerning the present status of certain plans held in abeyance. I have reference to matters outlined in the motu proprio of Pope Celestine VIII, of happy memory, given on the feast of the divine overshadowing of the Holy Virgin, Anno Domini 3735, and beginning with the words, he paused to look through the papers on his desk, Ab hac planeta nativitatis, aliquos filios ecclesiae usque, ad planetas solium alienorum iam abisse et numquam redituros esse intelligimus. Refer also to the confirming document of Anno Domini 3749. Quo peregrinatur Grex, pastor secum, authorizing the purchase of an island, certain vehicles. Lastly, refer to Casu Belli Nunc Remoto of the late Pope Paul, Anno Domini 3756, and the correspondence which followed between the Holy Father and my predecessor, culminating with an order transferring to us the task of holding the plan, quo peregrinatur, in a state of, suspended animation, but only so long as Your Eminence approves. Our state of readiness with respect to quo peregrinatur has been maintained, and should it become desirable to execute the plan, we would need, perhaps, 6 weeks' notice. While the abbot dictated, the abominable autoscribe did no more than record his voice and translate it into a phoneme code on tape. After he had finished speaking, he switched the process selector to analyze and pressed a button marked Text Processing. The ready lamp winked off. The machine began processing. Meanwhile, Zerke studied the documents before him. A chime sounded. The ready lamp winked on. The machine was silent. With only one nervous glance at the factory adjustment-only box, the abbot closed his eyes and pressed the right button. Clattery chat, clatter spatter pip, poppity cack fub clatter. The automatic writer chattered away at what he hoped would be the text of the radiogram. He listened hopefully to the rhythm of the keys. That first clattery chat, clatter spatter pip had sounded quite authoritative. He tried to hear the rhythms of Alleghenian speech in the sound of the typing, and after a time, he decided that there was indeed a certain Alleghenian lilt mixed into the rattle of the keys. He opened his eyes. Across the room, the robotic stenographer was briskly at work. He left his desk and went to watch it work. With utmost neatness, the abominable autoscribe was writing the Alleghenian equivalent of a mirror image of the exact text he had dictated.
Hey, Brother Pat!
He turned off the machine in disgust.
Holy Leibowitz, did we labor for this?
He could not see that it was any improvement over a carefully trimmed goose-quill pen and a pot of mulberry ink.
Hey, Pat!
There was no immediate response from the outer office, but after a few seconds, a monk with a red beard opened the door and, after glancing at the open cabinets, the littered floor, and the abbot's expression, he had the gall to smile.
What's the matter, Magister Meus? Don't you like our modern technology?
Not particularly, no, Zerke snapped. Hey, Pat!
He's out, my lord.
Brother Joshua, can't you fix this thing, really?
Really? No, I can't.
I've got to send a radiogram.
That's too bad, Father Abbot. Can't do that either. They just took our crystal and padlocked the shack.
They?
Zone Defense Interior. All private transmitters have been ordered off the air.
Zerke wandered to his chair and sank into it.
A defense alert? Why?
Joshua shrugged.
There's talk about an ultimatum. That's all I know, except what I hear from the radiation counters.
Still rising?
Still rising.
Call Spokane.
By mid-afternoon, the dusty wind had come. The wind came over the mesa and over the small city of Sanley Bowitz. It washed over the surrounding countryside,
noisily through the tall corn in the irrigated fields, tearing streamers of blowing sand from the sterile ridges. It moaned about the stone walls of the ancient abbey and about the aluminum and glass walls of the modern additions to the abbey. It besmirched the reddening sun with the dirt of the land and sent dust devils scurrying across the pavement of the 6-lane highway that separated the ancient abbey from its modern additions. On the side road, which at one point flanked the highway and led from the monastery by way of a residential suburb into the city, an old beggar clad in burlap paused to listen to the wind. The wind brought the throb of practice rocketry explosively from the south. Ground-to-space interceptor missiles were being fired toward target orbits from a launching range far across the desert. The old man gazed at the faint red disk of the sun while he leaned on his staff and muttered to himself, or to the sun,
"Omens, omens."
A group of children were playing in the weed-filled yard of a hovel just across the side road, their games proceeding under the mute but all-seeing auspices of a gnarled black woman who smoked a weed-filled pipe on the porch and offered an occasional word of solace or remonstrance to one or another tearful player who came as plaintiff before the grandmotherly court of her hovel porch. One of the children soon noticed the old tramp who stood across the roadway, and presently a shout went up.
Look it, it's old Lazar! Honest say, he be old Lazar, same one at the Lord Jesus raise up! Look it, Lazar, Lazar!
The children thronged to the broken fence. The old tramp regarded them grumpily for a moment, then wandered on along the road. A pebble skipped across the ground at his feet.
Hey, Lazar! Honest say, what the Lord Jesus raise up, it stay up. Look at him. Yeah, still hunting for the Lord, raise him up. Honest say.
Another rock skipped after the old man, but he did not look back. The old woman nodded sleepily. The children returned to their games. The dust storm thickened. Across the highway from the ancient abbey, atop one of the new aluminum and glass buildings, a monk on the roof was sampling the wind. He sampled it with a suction device, which ate the dusty air and blew the filtered wind to the intake of an air compressor on the floor below. The monk was no longer a youth, but not yet middle-aged. His short red beard seemed electrically charged, for it gathered pendant webs and streamers of dust. He scratched it irritably from time to time, and once he thrust his chin into the end of the suction hose. The result caused him to mutter explosively, then to cross himself. The compressor's motor coughed and died. The monk switched off the suction device, disconnected the blower hose, and pulled the device across the roof to the elevator and into the cage. Drifts of dust had settled into the corners. He closed the gate and pressed the down button. In the laboratory on the uppermost floor, he glanced at the compressor's gauge. It registered max norm. He closed the door, removed his habit, shook the dust out of it, hung it on a peg, and went over it with the suction device. Then, going to the deep, sheet-steel tank at the end of the laboratory workbench, he turned on the cold water and let it rise to the 200-jug mark. Thrusting his head into the water, he washed the mud from his beard and hair. The effect was pleasantly icy. Dripping and sputtering, he glanced at the door. The likelihood of visitors just now seemed small. He removed his underwear, climbed into the tank, and settled back with a shivery sigh. Abruptly, the door opened. Sister Helene came in with a tray of newly uncrated glassware. Startled, the monk leaped to his feet in the tub.
"Brother Joshua!" the sister shrieked.
Half a dozen beakers shattered on the floor. The monk sat down with a splash that sprayed the room. Sister Helene clucked, sputtered, squeaked, dumped the tray on the workbench, and fled. Joshua vaulted out of the sink and donned his habit, without bothering to dry himself or put on his underwear. When he got to the door, Sister Helene was already out of the corridor, probably out of the building and halfway to the sisters' chapel just down the side lane. Mortified, he hastened to complete his labors. He emptied the suction device's contents and collected a sample of the dust in a file. He took the file to the workbench, plugged in a pair of headphones, and held the file at a measured distance from the detector element of a radiation counter while he consulted his watch and listened. The compressor had a built-in counter. He pressed a stud marked Reset. The whirling decimal register flipped back to zero and began counting again. He stopped it after 1 minute and wrote the count on the back of his hand. It was mostly plain air, filtered and compressed, but there was a whiff of something else. He closed the lab for the afternoon
He went down to the office on the subjacent floor, wrote the count on a wall chart, eyed its perplexing upswing, then sat at his desk and flipped the viewphone switch. He dialed by feel while gazing at the telltale wall chart. The screen flashed, the phone beeped, and the viewer fluttered into focus on the back of an empty desk chair. After a few seconds, a man slid into the chair and peered into the viewer.
"Abbot Zerke here," the abbot grunted. "Oh, Brother Joshua, I was about to call you. Have you been taking a bath?"
"Yes, my lord abbot."
"You might at least blush."
"I am."
"Well, it doesn't show up on the viewer. Listen, on this side of the highway there's a sign just outside our gates. You've noticed it, of course. It says, 'Women beware, enter not lest,' and so forth. You've noticed it?"
"Surely, my lord."
"Take your oaths on this side of the sign."
"Certainly."
"Mortify yourself for offending sister's modesty. I'm aware that you haven't got any. Listen, I suppose you can't even bring yourself to pass the reservoir without jumping in, baby spanking bald for a swim."
"Who told you that, my lord? I mean, I've only waited—"
"Yes? Well, never mind. Why did you call me?"
"You wanted me to call Spokane."
"Oh, yes, did you?"
"Yes."
The monk gnawed at a bit of dry skin at the corner of his wind-cracked lips and paused uneasily.
"I talked to Father Leone. They've noticed it, too."
"The increased radiation count?"
"That's not all."
He hesitated again. He did not like saying it. To communicate a fact seemed always to lend it fuller existence. "Well?"
"It's connected with that seismic disturbance a few days ago. It's carried by the upper winds from that direction. All things considered, it looks like fallout from a low-altitude burst in the megaton range."
"Phew." Zerke sighed and covered his eyes with a hand. "Luciferum ruisse mihi dicis?"
"Yes, Domne, I'm afraid it was a weapon."
"Not possibly an industrial accident?"
"No."
"But if there were a war on, we'd know. An illicit test? But not that either. If they wanted to test one, they could test it on the far side of the moon, or better, Mars, and not be caught." Joshua nodded.
"So what does that leave?" the abbot went on. "A display? A threat? A warning shot fired over the bow?"
"That's all I could think of."
"So that explains the defense alert. Still, there's nothing in the news except rumors and refusals to comment, and with dead silence from Asia.
But the shot must have been reported from some of the observation satellites, unless, I don't like to suggest this, but unless somebody has discovered a way to shoot a space-to-Earth missile past the satellites, without detection until it's on the target."
"Is that possible?"
"There's been some talk about it, Father Abbot."
"The government knows. The government must know. Several of them know. And yet we hear nothing. We are being protected from hysteria. Isn't that what they call it?" "Maniacs. The world's been in a habitual state of crisis for 50 years. 50? What am I saying? It's been in a habitual state of crisis since the beginning. But for half a century now, almost unbearable. And why, for the love of God? What is the fundamental irritant, the essence of the tension? Political philosophies? Economics? Population pressure? Disparity of culture and creed? Ask a dozen experts, get a dozen answers. Now Lucifer again. Is the species congenitally insane, brother? If we're born mad, where's the hope of heaven? Through faith alone, or isn't there any?"
"God forgive me. I don't mean that. Listen, Joshua."
"My lord?"
"As soon as you close up shop, come back over here. That radiogram, I had to send Brother Pat into town to get it translated and sent by regular wire. I want you around when the answer comes. Do you know what it's about?"
Brother Joshua shook his head.
"Quo peregrinatur Grex."
The monk slowly lost color.
"To go into effect, Domne?"
"I'm just trying to learn the status of the plan. Don't mention it to anybody. Of course, you'll be affected. See me here when you're through."
"Certainly."
"Christecum.
Cum spirituo."
The circuit opened, the screen faded. The room was warm, but Joshua shivered. He gazed out the window into a premature twilight, murky with dust. He could see no farther than the storm fence next to the highway, where a passing procession of truck headlights made traveling halos in the dust haze.
After a while, he became aware of something standing near the gate, where the driveway opened onto the turnpike approach. The figure was dimly visible in silhouette whenever the headlights aurorae flashed by in review. Joshua shivered again. The silhouette was unmistakably that of Mrs. Grails. No one else would have been recognizable in such poor visibility, but the shape of the hooded bundle on her left shoulder and the way her head tilted toward the right made her outline uniquely that of old Ma'am Grails. The monk pulled curtains across the window and turned on the light. He was not repelled by the old woman's deformity. The world had grown blasé about such genetic mishaps and pranks of the genes. His own left hand still bore a tiny scar where a sixth finger had been removed during his infancy. But the heritage of the Diluvium Ignis was something he preferred to forget for the moment, and Mrs. Grails was one of its more conspicuous heirs. He fingered a globe of the world on his desk. He spun it so that the Pacific Ocean and continents and oceans became a blur. "Place your bets, sir and madam. Where?" He braked the globe abruptly with his thumb. "Bank. India pays off. Please collect, madam." The divination was wild. He spun the globe again until the axial mountings rattled. Days flitted by as briefest instants. In a reverse sense, he noticed suddenly. If Mother Gaia pirouetted in the same sense, the sun and other passing scenery would rise in the west and set in the east. Reversing time thereby? Said the namesake of my namesake, "Move not, O sun, toward Gabaon, nor thou, O moon, toward the valley." A neat trick, forsooth, and useful in these times, too. "Back up, O sun, et tu, luna, recedite in orbitas reversas." He kept spinning the globe in reverse, as if hoping the simulacrum of Earth possessed the chronos for unwinding time. A third of a million turns might unwind enough days to carry it back to the Diluvium Ignis. Better to use a motor and spin it back to the beginning of man. He stopped it again with his thumb. Once more the divination was wild. Still he lingered in the office and dreaded going home again. Home was only across the highway, in the haunted halls of those ancient buildings whose walls still contained stones which had been the rubbled concrete of a civilization that had died 18 centuries ago. Crossing the highway to the old abbey was like crossing an eon. Here in the new aluminum and glass buildings, he was a technician at a workbench, where events were only phenomena to be observed with regard for their how, not questioning their why. On this side of the road, the falling of Lucifer was only an inference derived by cold arithmetic from the chatter of radiation counters, from the sudden swing of a seismograph pen. But in the old abbey, he ceased to be a technician. Over there he was a monk of Christ, a booklegger and memorizer in the community of Leibowitz. Over there, the question would be, "Why, Lord, why?" But the question had already come, and the abbot had said, "See me." Joshua reached for his bindle stiff and went to obey the summons of his ruler. To avoid meeting Mrs. Grails, he used the pedestrian underpass. It was no time for pleasant conversation with the bicephalous old tomato woman. Chapter 25. The dike of secrecy had broken. Several dauntless Dutch boys were swept away by the raging tide. The tide swept them right out of Texarkana to their country estates, where they became unavailable for comment. Others remained at their posts and staunchly tried to plug new leaks. But the fall of certain isotopes in the wind created a universal byword, spoken on street corners and screamed by banner headlines. "Lucifer is fallen." The Minister of Defense, his uniform immaculate, his makeup unsmeared, and his equanimity unruffled, again faced the journalistic fraternity. This time the press conference was televised throughout the Christian coalition. "Lady reporter, your lordship appears rather calm in the face of the facts. Two violations of international law, both defined by treaty as warlike acts, have recently occurred. Doesn't that worry the war ministry at all?" Defense Minister: "Madam, as you very well know, we do not have a war ministry here. We have a defense ministry. And as far as I know, only one violation of international law has occurred. Would you mind acquainting me with the other?" Lady reporter: "Which one are you not acquainted with? The disaster in Itaewon, or the warning shot over the South Pacific?" Defense Minister, suddenly stern:
Surely Madam intends nothing seditious, but your question seems to give comfort, if not credence, to the utterly false Asian charges that the so-called Itouan disaster was the result of a weapon test by us and not by them. Lady Reporter. If it does, I invite you to throw me in jail. The question was based on a Near East neutralist account, which reported that the Itouan disaster was the result of an Asian weapon test underground, which broke free. The same account said that the Itouan test was sighted from our satellites and immediately answered by a space-to-Earth warning shot southeast of New Zealand. But now that you suggest it, was the Itouan disaster also the result of a weapon test by us? Defense Minister, with forced patience. I recognize the journalistic requirement of objectivity, but to suggest that His Supremacy's government would deliberately violate... Lady Reporter. His Supremacy is an 11-year-old boy, and to call it his government is not only archaic, but a highly dishonorable, even cheap attempt to shift the responsibility for a full denial from your own... Moderator. Madam, please restrain the tenor of your... Defense Minister. Overlook it, overlook it. Madam, you have my full denial if you must dignify the fantastic charges. The so-called Itouan disaster was not the result of a weapon test by us. Nor do I have any knowledge of any other recent nuclear detonation. Lady Reporter. Thank you. Moderator. I believe the editor of the Texarkana Star Insight has been trying to speak. Editor. Thank you. I should like to ask your lordship, what did happen in Itouan? Defense Minister. We have no nationals in that area. We have had no observers there since diplomatic relations were broken during the last world crisis. I can, therefore, only rely upon indirect evidence and the somewhat conflicting neutralist accounts. Editor, that is to be understood. Defense Minister, very well then. I gather there was a subsurface nuclear detonation in the megaton range, and it got out of hand. It was rather obviously a test of some sort. Whether it was a weapon or, as some Asia fringe neutrals claim, an attempt to divert an underground river, it was clearly illegal, and adjoining countries are preparing a protest to the World Court. Editor, is there any risk of war? Defense Minister, I foresee none. But as you know, we have certain detachments of our armed forces which are subject to conscription by the World Court to enforce its decisions, if needed. I foresee no such need, but I cannot speak for the court. First Reporter, but the Asian coalition has threatened an immediate all-out strike against our space installations if the court does not take action against us. What if the court is slow in acting? Defense Minister. No ultimatum has been delivered. The threat was for Asian home consumption, as I see it, to cover their blunder in Itouan. Lady Reporter. How is your abiding faith in motherhood today, Lord Ragel? Defense Minister. I hope motherhood has at least as much abiding faith in me as I have in motherhood. Lady Reporter, you deserve at least that much, I'm sure. The news conference, radiated from the relay satellite 22,000 miles from Earth, bathed most of the Western Hemisphere with the flickering VHF signal, which carried such intelligence to the panelescent wall screens of the multitudes. One among the multitudes, Abbot Dom Zerki, switched off the set. He paced for a while, waiting for Joshua, trying not to think. But not thinking proved impossible. Listen, are we helpless? Are we doomed to do it again and again and again? Have we no choice but to play the Phoenix in an unending sequence of rise and fall? Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Greece, Carthage, Rome, the empires of Charlemagne and the Turk, ground to dust and plowed with salt, Spain, France, Britain, America, burned into the oblivion of the centuries, and again, and again, and again. Are we doomed to it, Lord, chained to the pendulum of our own mad clockwork, helpless to halt its swing? This time it will swing us clean to oblivion, he thought. The feeling of desperation passed abruptly when Brother Pat brought him the second telegram. The abbot ripped it open, read it at a glance, and chuckled. Brother Joshua here yet, brother? Waiting outside, Reverend Father. Send him in. Oh, brother, shut the door and turn on the silencer, then read this. Joshua glanced at the first telegram. An answer from New Rome? It came this morning, but turn on that silencer first. We've got things to discuss.
Joshua closed the door and flipped a wall switch. Concealed loudspeakers squealed a brief protest. When the squealing stopped, the room's acoustic properties seemed suddenly changed. Dom Zerke waved him toward a chair, and he read the first telegram in silence.
No action whatever to be taken by you in connection with Quo Peregrinatur Grex, he read aloud.
You'll have to shout with that thing on, said the abbot, indicating the silencer.
What?
I was just reading, so the plan is cancelled?
Don't look so relieved. That came this morning. This came this afternoon.
The abbot tossed him the second telegram.
Ignore earlier message of this date. Quo Peregrinatur to be reactivated immediately by request of Holy Father. Prepare Kadri to leave within 3 days. Wait for confirming wire before departure. Report any vacancies in Kadri organization. Begin confidential implementation of plan. Eric Cardinal Hofstraff, Vicar of Post, Extra Terre, Provinciae.
The monk's face lost color. He replaced the telegram on the desk and sat back in his chair, lips tight together.
You know what Quo Peregrinatur is?
I know what it is, Domine, but not in detail.
Well, it started as a plan to send a few priests along with a colony group heading for Alpha Centauri. But that didn't work out because it takes bishops to ordain priests, and after the first generation of colonists, more priests would have to be sent, and so on. The question boiled down to an argument about whether the colonies would last, and if so, should provision be made to ensure the apostolic succession on colony planets without recourse to Earth. You know what that would mean.
Sending at least 3 bishops, I imagine.
Yes, and that seemed a little silly. The colony groups have all been rather small. But during the last world crisis, Quo Peregrinatur became an emergency plan for perpetuating the Church on the colony planets if the worst came to pass on Earth. We have a ship.
A starship?
No less, and we have a crew capable of managing it.
Where?
We have the crew right here.
Here at the Abbey? But who?
Joshua stopped. His face grew even grayer than before.
But, Domine, my experience in space has been entirely in orbital vehicles, not in starships. Before Nancy died and I went to the Sisters...
I know all about that. There are others with starship experience. You know who they are. There are even jokes about the number of ex-spacers that seem to feel a vocation to our order. It's no accident, of course. And you remember when you were a postulant, how you were quizzed about your experience in space?
Joshua nodded.
You must also remember being asked about your willingness to go to space again, if the order asked it of you.
Yes?
Then you were not wholly unaware that you were conditionally assigned to Quo Peregrinatur, if it ever came to pass.
This book is continued on Cassette 7, Side 1.